Hello and welcome to Total Film's spoiler special on Spider-Man No Way Home, the latest MCU movie to hit cinemas and the third in Tom Holland's Spidey trilogy. I'm Matt Matem, Deputy Editor of Total Film, and I'm joined by our news editor, Jordan Farley.
Hello.
And our online editor, Jack Shepherd.
Hello.
Now, this is a spoiler special and the clue is in the name. There will be full spoilers for Spider-Man No Way Home and anything else in the MCU up to this point. So if you're not up to date and haven't yet seen No Way Home, this is your spoiler warning klaxon. So if you haven't seen Spider-Man No Way Home, please stop listening, go away, catch up and come back to us when you've seen it, because we're going to go into full detail. So if you are still with us, get ready, because we're going to dive in now and discuss everything about Spider-Man No Way Home in full spoilery detail, no holds barred. So here we go.
When you botched that spell where you wanted everyone to forget that Peter Parker's Spider-Man, we started getting some visitors. From every universe. Hello, Peter.
So to start, actually, I first just wanted to get your thoughts on No Way Home's box office opening, because it's just opened this weekend worldwide, pretty much. And it's taken $587 million worldwide, making it the third biggest worldwide debut of all time, only following the two most recent Avengers team-up films. Does that surprise you that it's done quite so well?
It's extraordinary given the circumstances, at least given that we're still, you know, the rise of the Omicron variant means that some people are not going out as much as they perhaps would. But yeah, that is quite exceptional. The thing that it highlights for me is just this enormous discrepancy between the kind of films that people will actually go to the cinema to see now. Like, clearly the appetite for Marvel and event movies hasn't abated at all, whereas, you know, the adult focused indie films, the dramas, they're the ones that have really taken a nosedive at the box office. So it really feels like people are saving their 1, 2, 3 cinema trips a month to go to these huge films.
I mean, it felt the same for me going to see this as well, because like, there are many other movies that I want to see and probably should have seen, like Licorice Pizza, which I'm dead excited for. But I was like, at the moment, I only really want to risk going to see one. So I'll save it up and go see Spider-Man, because I know everyone's going to be talking about it. I imagine a lot of people have probably done the same. And I think it's probably going to affect The Matrix 4 in quite a hefty way, because I think people have gone, right, I've seen Spider-Man, I'm not sure if I want to go to another big cinema event, or people will.
That's my pre-Christmas risk. I've taken my pre-Christmas risk.
Yeah, exactly.
it is true though, right? It's so close to Christmas. Like, do you want to risk like not seeing your family for like the second year in a row for the sake of seeing The Matrix on the day it comes out? You know, like, it is a legitimate question to ask. I mean, the other thing with Spider-Man, of course, is that they were very clever in the way that they sold it, in the sense that it felt like a film you had to see, like, immediately, otherwise you risked having it spoiled for you. As we're going to discuss in the spoiler special, there are like huge things in it that you just wouldn't want to know before going into it. So I can totally understand the mindset, which is like, I need to see this the day it comes out, so it's not ruined like this whole experience.
I think it was the same for Endgame as well, because it was like that moment of like, I don't want the internet ruining this for me. And obviously that made like 1.3 bill at the box office, like crazy amounts never before seen, you know, just because I think people are rushing to avoid spoilers. And I think you know, Marvel have kind of cultivated that feeling, and when you've got all the actors being asked all the time and they're like just lying at this stage, just saying like, I'm not in it, please stop asking me, you know, you want to be that first person to go like, Andrew Garfield was lying to us all.
I can't wait to see like to hear or see the first interview with him about this, to see what his mea culpa is, you know. I can totally understand why he did it, but it's quite funny to watch some of those interviews now and him be so sincerely denying the fact that he's in it.
So that actually leads us quite nicely into the first big talking point, and kind of the most obvious talking point you just have to dive into after seeing No Way Home, but which is multiple Spider-Men. So, of course, as you mentioned, Andrew Garfield and, of course, Tobey Maguire did return as Peter Parker's in this, zapped over from another multiverse. Was this the worst kept secret in recent movie history?
I'm trying to think of a worse one. I can't think of one.
Did you have any doubts they would be in it?
Yeah, I mean, Garfield, I was totally convinced. he's such a good actor. Like, I believed him totally that he wasn't in it for a while. I don't know. I always sort of felt they still had to be in it, right? Mm. You can't be bringing in villains from these various incarnations of Spider-Man and not bring the actual Spider-Man in. That would have been just insane and cruel to do, I think. So, yeah, to quote Thanos, inevitable, but something about it, I did have my doubts. I didn't want to get my hopes up too much, you know? I didn't want to be like, yeah, they're definitely in it, and then just be gutted if they weren't. But I'm glad they delivered. Yeah.
It was weird how they kept their powder so dry in the marketing. Like, we didn't even get like a sort of, like in the Ghostbusters Afterlife trailer where, you know, you get that kind of brief glimpse of sort of the side of Ray when he answers the phone. It was just, I thought, I'm just surprised they didn't release any trailers where there was like, you know, you saw the back of a different Spider-Man and people looking up like, oh, who's this? You know,
but I mean, obviously it worked. Yeah. If everyone went to see it.
We left the cinema after we saw it last week and we were stood outside just chatting around and a complete stranger walked up to us and asked if Tobey Maguire and Andrew Garfield were in it. And he was just desperate to know if they were in it. And it just gave me a real insight into the mindset of someone who absolutely loves Spider-Man, just desperately wants to know if they're in it or not. I mean, that's why people turned up in such huge numbers and on its opening weekend, I guess. Like, people just need to know.
I mean, one thing that was perhaps surprising is they do get quite a decent amount of screen time, don't they? Because I had half wondered with all these, you know, rumors and everything, I thought, oh, are they going to just turn up right at the end, or that you're going to get an action scene where they're all in full Spidey masks, so it could be any old stuntman doing it, and then they'll whip off their masks for a little speech at the end before they leave. But they're in it a decent amount, aren't they? That was a lot to kind of keep under wraps all that time.
That was my favorite part of the movie, just having the three of them interact. I mean, I thought Garfield's Spider-Man kind of stole the show. Kind of slightly depressed after the events of Amazing Spider-Man 2, and then kind of coming back and being with his, like, these guys who are suddenly calling his brothers and saying he loved them and all this stuff. And it was just really nice and felt quite sincere and felt like a lot of weight was coming off that Peter Parker's shoulders, but also perhaps Andrew Garfield's, where like his Spider-Man was finally getting like a good ending for once, you know, because the last we saw it was just, you know, he was mid swing fighting Rhino, which feels like decades ago, but it was what, 6 years ago, 5 years ago.
And they take the piss out of Rhino as well, which is quite funny.
It's crazy that, yeah, like the first Sam Raimi Spider-Man was 2002. So basically 20 years ago. So it's weird that all this has fitted within 20 years. I don't know. It feels like you're saying, Garfield's just feels like so much longer ago, but Amazing Spider-Man 2 was like only 7 years ago, wasn't it? 7.5 years
ago. It was during the MCU, not the MCU Spider-Man, but like while the MCU was going on, which I find kind of nuts somehow. Like, there was probably a universe where like he might have, you know, crossed over with the Avengers or something, which, you know, would have been very strange looking back now.
Well, but he has crossed over with a couple of Avengers now.
Yeah,
Spidey and Doctor Strange. I totally agree with you. Andrew Garfield was a real sort of standout for me, which is possibly the most surprising thing, because I really don't like either of his films, to be honest. I love the chemistry between his Peter Parker and Gwen Stacy, but I don't think those films have much going for themselves apart from that. And yeah, it was incredibly surprising just how much they were in it. I was totally in agreement with you, Matt. I thought they were going to be a brief cameo at the end at most, but you get a good, I don't know, it felt like 40 minutes plus with them, which is incredible. Amazing that they were able to, I don't know, sneak them in and off set like under hoodies or whatever. I don't know what security measures they employed to pull that off and not have it exposed, but yeah, they really delivered in that sense. They didn't just shortchange you on Spider-Men's. They really gave you your money's worth.
That obviously was the real thing of the film, I'd say, that made it a must-see, even if the film didn't 100% work for me. I mean, you have to see that. You know, there is still a giddy thrill to that. And it's, again, one of the things you can't discuss in non-spoiler reviews. It just makes it really tricky to kind of weigh up the merits. But sort of, what kind of worked and didn't work for you regarding these kind of multiple Spider-Men.
I really like the introduction. I mean, I was expecting to see Toby's Spider-Man first, and then when it was Garfield, that was a slight surprise, because I was like, oh, he's the less popular one. And then in my head, I was thinking, oh God, maybe they just couldn't afford to bring Toby back. But then luckily he comes along too. So it was like, I was like relieved and also just like, wow, this is like insane, because he grew up with that Spider-Man. It's like our Spider-Man. I don't know. It was really cool. And I think our screening, there was lots of clapping and all sorts of like that, which was like fun to be part of. I found, I know lots of people don't like clapping in cinemas, but I don't know. It felt like a momentous moment. And so, you know, and the camaraderie and the chemistry between the three of them, like I could have just watched the whole movie on that. I thought it was really, really fun. I was slightly disappointed by the final set piece, not because of them, because I, you know, there's one shot where they kind of swing in and the moon's behind them and it's like, wow, this is cool. But the actual fight itself was, I found, kind of visually quite underwhelming as a whole, like set at night for the most part. I don't know. There was something about it that didn't quite click for me. What did you guys think?
Yeah, I think the decision to say it at night was probably an error, to be honest. It was very hard to distinguish between the three Spider-Man suits, especially because they're visually quite different if you see them in very clear light. But watching it in this film, it felt like I really struggled to tell which Spider-Man was which sometimes, which is a real shame, because you want to feel like you know who you're watching in any given moment, especially when you've got the opportunity to see, you know, Tobey Maguire's Spidey for the first time in almost 20 years on screen. Felt like a disappointment that I wasn't 100% sure who was where and when, you know?
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that. What did you guys think in terms of, obviously, we've been in very similar territory in Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse a couple of years ago, the animated film, which was so good and probably for me is the best Spider-Man film, I would say. But did you feel like it kind of this lost something on account of following that and the fact we'd seen the idea done, or because this was live action, you know, and the kind of, you know, the actors we know, was that enough to sort of make it work for you on its own terms?
They're almost hard to compare, right? Visually, like, Spider-Verse is just on a whole other level to No Way Home. Like, there's no getting around that fact. I think that was very difficult to do in live action. I don't know how you could create anything just as colorful and creative as Spider-Verse with real actors. That'd just be almost impossible, I think. But the fact that, you know, it is the real actors playing these characters, these beloved characters, I think that does go a long way to make up for the fact that maybe some of the elements aren't as ambitious or inventive and creative as what we saw in Spider-Verse, which is, you know, it's just such a wonderful film. It's such a wonderful Spider-Man film. So it wasn't a huge issue for me. Like, I was able to separate them, and they both offer something different, and they both play to the strengths of, you know, the live action and animated mediums, which makes sense.
Even tonally, Spider-Verse is a much more fun film in general. You know, it kind of like really whips along. They bring in, you know, Spider Pig, Spider Ham, you know, Spider Man Noir.
Do you not remember that they kill Peter Parker at the beginning of that film? It gets pretty dark. And his uncle dies.
Uncle Ben dies a few times, doesn't he? They go through it. But I think maybe it's just more colourful. I'm won over by the colours.
No, I agree. I'm being facetious, because that was one of the surprising things about No Way Home, right? I mean, not so surprising, because Tom Holland actually told you this, Jack, but it was such a dark film, I thought, at times. It's got really heavy and like emotional at points, which, given how breezy and fun Homecoming, Far From Home are, I was a little surprised that they went, you know, quite that heavy with it.
I interviewed Tom Holland for this, for Total Film a while back, and he kind of said it was like brutal and dark. And you know, actors kind of say things to make their films feel exciting, obviously, but I still wasn't really ready for, like, especially the midsection of this film, and especially how low Holland's Peter Parker gets, like that scene when he's sobbing on the roof of his school. This is like one of the saddest moments in the MCU. like, it gets really quite upsetting, especially like Aunt May's death. It's like, it's quite, it takes you back quite a bit.
I mean, did you feel like Aunt May was fridged somewhat, to use the comics parlance.
That was probably one of my least favorite scenes, if I'm perfectly honest. I thought both of the performers did a decent job with it, Marissa Tomei and Tom Holland. I don't know, it just felt unnecessary to me. I don't really know why they had to do it. And I didn't entirely buy Tom Holland's then turn into like this, you know, vengeance-ridden guy. Because I just don't see Tom Holland as Tom Holland Spider-Man, his Peter Parker, as that type of person, you know. Like, I just didn't buy that he would be so angry.
Especially as well as the whole film kind of hinges on the fact that he's so good that he wants to reform these villains that are coming over rather than just, you know, send them back basically to their doom. So that kind of didn't add up for me as well. But just a couple more things I just wanted to ask you guys before we move on from this topic. Two things which were questionable to me, so I wanted to know your thoughts. Well, one, I wasn't sure how I felt about Andrew Garfield saving MJ when she was falling and effectively, I suppose, redeeming himself from his tragedy from his own second film when Gwen Stacy died, when he was kind of saving her. What did you guys think of that? Did that work for you as a sort of emotional moment or not?
I'd say it worked for me. I thought it was definitely felt full circle for that character. And I don't know, I found it quite moving, that moment. So what was your issue with it, Matt? That's what I want to know. Like, where did you take...
I suppose for me, it just felt like too quick and easy and almost cheap of a like, all right, let's quickly redeem this character who's been sort of, you know, again, as far as I understand it in this story world, he's just been carrying on for the last 7 years in his own world, gone to some very dark places. And it was just such a quick, like, oh, here he goes. He's now saved himself and everything's fine because he's managed to just get in exactly the same situation as he was in before. But this time he's managed to grab her without snapping her back into.
I'm totally with Jack on this. I have to disagree with you, Matt. I thought that scene was actually probably my favorite scene in the whole film. I thought it was just completely wonderful. Because even though I really dislike The Amazing Spider-Man 2 as a whole, that moment where Gwen Stacy dies is so just impactful and shocking. Like, that really stuck with me after watching it to the extent that I just associate Andrew Garfield's Spider-Man with that moment in that film. So seeing, you know, him redeem himself in that moment very quickly, admittedly, but it's his reaction to it after he saves MJ, which I just like actually like made me well up, where he's just like checking if she's okay. And like, he's on the verge of tears and it's like, oh man. It was so overwhelming. I thought it was completely nailed that moment for me, I thought. And that was another moment where I think people were sort of expecting it because it's sort of teased in the trailer that, you know, obviously MJ's falling and you sort of assume that someone's going to save her, a Spider-Man's going to save her, but we didn't know about Garfield's Spider-Man then. But the fact that even though I was expecting it and it still exceeded my expectations, I thought they really nailed that moment.
Maybe I need to see it again because I did really like his performance. He was the standout for me, as we sort of said earlier. And I liked his reaction afterwards, but there's just something about the whole moment I just didn't quite buy. But again, maybe I was just being a bit grumpy. I don't know.
I know you just said like, well, presumably Spidey's been like crime hunting in his universe for like years since. I kind of got the impression he hadn't been, like he'd completely given up all that lifestyle and this was therefore like a real kind of renewed sense of I should get back to my crime fighting days, like through this movie, you know, even like talking with the other boys and kind of being a bit more revved up afterwards. I thought this was like, I mean, this is like, could be, I feel, a great launch pad for The Amazing Spider-Man 3. And I'm very ready for this film where like you got this new Andrew Garfield Spider-Man who's like, ah, I'm like finally feeling better. And he can go fight like Tom Hardy's Venom.
Things can get so tangled, can't they? Yeah.
God, can you imagine? Yeah. Bring back Dane DeHaan, I say. No, don't bring back Dane DeHaan.
But on that note as well, what did you guys think of Tobey Maguire getting stabbed at the end and then just basically being fine? Because I was like, oh, whoa, they've killed him off when he got that really bad stab. I think seemingly went through his entire body, like from the Green Goblin. But then just a bit later, he was just, you know, wobbling off fine.
Well, I mean, as you say, he's been stabbed before. So, you know, Spider-Man obviously heal quick as well, don't they? Because Tom Holland's Peter Parker complains about having a broken rib at one point, doesn't he? Or a cracked rib. And he seems fine by the end. But more generally, I was just delighted to see Tobey Maguire in this. Obviously, it's been what, 7, 8 years since he's even been in a film, so it's been close to a decade that I've even seen his face. And I actually found it quite moving just to see, yeah, the fact that he aged and, you know, the Peter Parker that I grew up with was now a 40 something who, you know, he looks good, but he looks like a 40 something. And there's that great moment where he speaks to Doc Ock just so briefly, like almost too briefly, where Doc Ock says, like, "You've grown up, my boy," or whatever. I just found that really, yeah, quite sweet. They did really well with those little just grace note moments where they weren't, you know, essential to the plot or the action or anything, but they just left you feeling like, oh, they kind of get what we want to see from these films, even if they give it to you in the briefest of moments. But yeah, the stab did leave me a little worried because we, you know, we'd seen the fact that they were willing to kill off May, and I thought, oh no, they can't do this to Toby's Peter Parker. But I was so glad when he said it's, I'll be fine. Like, whew, thank God for that.
It felt a bit Star Wars sequel trilogy as well, almost like, oh, let's bring Han Solo back so we can finish him off.
I do kind of take issue with the stabbing because I thought it was like quite weirdly just thrown in at the end. But I also really had an issue with like Tom Holland wanting to kill Green Goblin anyway. I understand that they needed to get to a point where he was so angry that he was gonna like kill him and they could kind of go through the motions of this scene. But it didn't really feel justified after everything that he'd kind of gone through and like all the speeches about Uncle Ben's and Aunt May's and like him being better than that. I wasn't sure why they necessarily needed to have Tobey Maguire kind of like holding the glider and stopping that from happening, or like just why Tom Holland would kind of go over and kill him. I thought it was like maybe Tom Holland would like beat him up and leave Green Goblin kind of like lying there and then stop himself and like having learned his lesson rather than needing Toby to swing in there and do it. I don't know. There was just something slightly off about that entire scene. But he like really quickly learns his lesson, and then Andrew Garfield like throws over the vial and he stabs Green Goblin. It's like all sorted, and it's just like, oh, now he knows. It's like you nearly killed him. You're really doing like a big swing here. I think it kind of sums up some of my issues with the film in general, though, because I really like the fan servicey bits that Jordan's talking about, because I really love the Spider-Man films. So like it's brief mentions of all these things, you know, the bit where like all the Peters are like pointing at each other and it's like the meme, and the bit where Green Goblin's just like, I'm something of a scientist myself. And it's like, yeah, this is awesome. But the decisions to get everyone into this film, so even kind of bringing back all the villains, required Doctor Strange to do something really stupid, required Tom Holland's Peter Parker to want the world to forget him just so him and his friends can get into like MIT. They even joke about him like not calling up the school and stuff like that. It's like all these kind of weird decisions when you think about them. It's just like they've just beat Thanos and now they're all really dumb again. So I kind of have issues with just the way a lot of these decisions were like played to get to these really cool moments. Do you know what I'm
Oh yeah,
saying?
totally. That was my biggest beef with the film as well overall, and why, again, as we kind of discussed on the non-spoiler review, why I feel like it's sort of a must-see, even if I still only think it is a 3-star film, because it has these great moments that, you know, again, literally must see, hence why so many people turned out the cinema to see them. But in order to get to that place, it felt like they had to engineer a lot that just didn't feel kind of natural. Like, as you said, the Doctor Strange participation didn't seem like he would have done that. It didn't feel like Peter Parker would. I know he's, you know, he's young and naive and whatnot, but he is a very clever, you know, boy as well. So I just don't feel like he would have necessarily made this decision. I don't feel like once you've saved the world from Thanos and once you're a sort of protege of Tony Stark, you necessarily are as fussed about going to college anymore. I just think that, yeah, like that. I know it's that kind of thing where it's like they're trying to give it that teen movie feel with teen movie motivations. And even just the very act of like them going into the spell with Doctor Strange, just so kind of, you know, unprepared, changing his mind halfway through, you know, mucking up the spell. Like, why would you not just take a bit of time to sort of think it through a bit more and say, look, so I'm going to go home, going to get my thoughts straight and come back tomorrow with a clear idea of this spell. But instead, they both just dive into it, mucking it up sort of along the way. And then all hell breaks loose and they're surprised.
Yeah, I don't entirely disagree with what you're saying. It felt very clear to me that this was a film where they knew where they wanted to end up and they had to engineer a situation to get to that point. And it felt like some of the decisions they made weren't 100% logical. But I did get the sense that, you know, they know these characters inside out. And I think that they did the best they could under the circumstances. Like, I don't entirely not believe that Doctor Strange would fuck the spell because of his hubris or overconfidence. You know, as we know, this is a spell he's performed before. He was just a guy that, you know, we've seen him in the MCU before not do things perfectly. So that did feel consistent to me enough that I could just about believe it. And it wasn't a big enough deal that it ruined my enjoyment of the film.
Because I suppose for me, it also hinged on another weird thing, which was that it's such a huge deal that Spider-Man's identity has been revealed kind of at the end of Far From Home by the new version of J. Jonah Jameson. And it's obviously that's what kind of drives then all of Peter's decisions from then on. But I kind of almost didn't quite buy that the revealing of his identity would have been such a huge deal as it was presented in the film. Simply because this is a world where, like, they've lived through the blip. You know, they've known that Tony Stark is Iron Man for the last, like, 10 years or something of this world. Like, Captain America is a sort of a history figure to them. Like, they would sort of learn about him in their history books. So I just found it hard to believe that it was just, there was such uproar when it was revealed who Spider-Man was. I don't know. Did you guys feel that?
I don't know. I kind of get it because I think, you know, we're mainly following Spider-Man's perspective anyway. So, you know, it could just be in New York that everyone's obsessing over it. And I think that does make sense because if you found out, like, oh, there's a guy like down your road who's supposed to be like this mega hero, you'd be like, whoa, like there would be so many people. There would be a lot of fanfare. And I thought the opening scene, the bit where it was kind of all hand cam and they were going round the flat, Maze flat and stuff. I thought that was done really, really well. And I thought a lot of that stuff was really fun and done really well. But I do feel like it was reverse engineered to the point where it was like, look, we have this endpoint. We have all these characters we want to bring back. We need to kind of come up with a way of getting there. And what's interesting, I mean, this was originally supposed to come out after Doctor Strange 2, which was always going to be a multiverse film. And so you can kind of see where they've gone, we were going to bring back these characters anyway because it's multiverse, but we need to change the order. So we need to introduce the multiverse here rather than in Doctor Strange 2, and therefore kind of like have to go back and kind of rewrite a story to make it work in that order, which I guess is just part of the, you know, pandemic delays and all that, but does feel like it probably made quite a sizable impact on some of those story decisions. Well, made early in the film.
Well, the multiverse is properly introduced in the final episode of Loki, right? Spoilers for the last season of Loki. Because I thought the last episode of Loki dovetailed into this quite well, because I guess the timeline here is the multiverse is cracked open at the end of Loki, right? By He Who Remains. And then here, Doctor Strange is inviting people from the multiverse into this universe, into the MCU universe. It's not like the multiverse is broken open here. So I thought that was all quite elegantly handled, actually. Like, I was wondering, because it started to feel like it was getting quite confusing how they were handling the multiverse, like where and when it opened and how people were coming in. Was the multiverse always there? But I thought here it felt like, oh yeah, this is like the next step from what we've seen before, which I actually quite liked.
Yeah, I'm still somewhat confused. I feel like this is a good thing, I suppose, ultimately. But I feel like all the recent Marvel stuff, it feels like everything is like a big deal for like the future of Marvel. Maybe because we're at a stage now where after Endgame, they're kind of setting up a lot of new characters and they've got to kind of, you know, get a completely new kind of larger arc going, you know, now that the sort of Thanos Infinity saga is complete. But End of Eternals, it feels like, well, this feels big for the sort of, you know, future of the MCU. Even at the end of Shang-Chi, I was like, oh, this feels pretty big for like the future of the MCU. Like it's just everything, like Loki obviously felt huge. It just everything's like, it feels just huge for the future of the MCU.
Yeah. I mean, we can obviously talk about this because it's a spoiler special, but I'm jumping ahead a bit, but this film ends with a trailer for Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, of course. And I was just thinking, watching that, if you're not up to speed with What If and like the Doctor Strange episodes of What If, which feels like a series that not everyone watched, like, would you get what some of this stuff is? But, like, well, suddenly there's like a dark Doctor Strange. Yeah. Like, you gonna have any idea what that is? But
I can say I'm actually not up to speed on What If. well, but when go. I saw that, I kind of I didn't realize they were riffing on
previously.
No, I didn't realize it was set up previously, but it still seemed like it was a kind of easy enough idea to grasp, like, oh, okay, this is a bad, like almost a bit like I mean, Community, I suppose, like from the dark timelines and stuff. It felt like, oh, this is the Doctor Strange from a bad timeline.
My overarching feeling is that, like, we're getting to a stage where there's just so much homework to be done. But at the same time, because they still do it in a way that, like, if you haven't seen those things, you still kind of understand. It comes to a point where, like, if you have watched those things, then it kind of feels like, oh, are they taking that into account as, like, seriously as they should? Like, with that Doctor Strange trailer, like, bringing back Wanda, you know, they mentioned Westview, which was the WandaVision series and all the events that happened there, and then kind of go, oh, don't worry about that. And it's like, whoa, wait a minute. Like, is that not, like, part of her character development then? Like, these 9 hours or however long it was of, like, TV that we've just watched, which was, like, probably my favorite MCU thing of this year. But then are we going to ignore that? Like, what if people are going to the cinema and haven't seen that? Like, are they expected to have watched that now? Or are you, like, able to get the grasp? I don't know. It feels like there's just a lot of questions where, and, like, Loki with this, I mean, I kind of see the link. I also think, like, I have no idea how that's going to pan out, like the crack in the multiverse. Like, is that affecting all these things? Is it all because of that? Or is it the other way around where it's this affecting that? I don't know. The timeline's weird. All this stuff's connected in, like, crazy ways where it's like, when is it going to become too much? Like, because I haven't finished What If either. I think I got like 4, 5, or 6 episodes into it, and I was like, this is fine. But there wasn't a need to, like, watch it weekly, although I now know that they all interconnect.
Yeah, same. Yeah,
I would say What If is increasingly feeling like essential viewing, to be honest. It was quite interesting, even just down to the fact that, you know, when you see the cracks in the multiverse at the end of No Way Home, it's exactly the same, you know, visual style cracks that you had in What If when the Watcher was kind of watching through them. So it feels like everything's dovetailing together in quite a neat way if you've watched all this stuff. The tricky thing for them, of course, is they can't count on the fact that everyone will be 100% up to speed on everything. And how do they account for that? And how do they deal with that? But, you know, it's popular enough that I guess they assume most people are up to speed.
I just don't know when do you stop introducing, like, new characters and new ideas to when it, like, you know, like, never. Eternals introducing, like, a big... they've got the big creature thing under the water that just tried to wipe out, like, the whole of Earth. If they don't mention that in, like, Doctor Strange 2 or something like that, like, is that an issue? Is that something I'm going to be thinking about where I'm just like, guys, like, what? I know this has always been, like, a repeated thing where it's like, oh, where's Iron Man in all this? Or, you know, where's Thor? Why isn't he helping? Which I can kind of get over. But then there are certain massive things like the multiverse breaking down and stuff. Like, surely that's just going to affect everything going forward. Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness feels like it's just going to have such a massive effect, kind of like the blip. You know, it's one of those things that you kind of can't get away from referencing. And where do you get to a point where there's just so much of that? I don't know. I think it's a lot, but we watch it all, so it's fine.
Talking of needing to be up to date with kind of TV shows to keep up with the MCU these days, there was kind of a big TV-related surprise in this film, wasn't there, early on, when Matt Murdock turned up, played by Charlie Cox.
Yeah, he did. Very exciting.
I mean, that was kind of the extent of it. He didn't really do much, did he? One quick catch.
His appearance wasn't significant in terms of the things that he did, but it is significant in terms of what it means going forward. The fact that we now know that for definite, the Netflix Marvel characters are part of the MCU, or at the very least, Matt Murdock is.
Mm.
That's super cool because I absolutely love the Daredevil Netflix series. I thought it was exceptional. I actually prefer it to any of the MCU series so far. I think it's superb. I think Charlie Cox is just an excellent Matt Murdock. I loved his fighting style, especially, just incredible. They need to bring some of that to the MCU. So it was great to see him in this. I was sort of slightly confused why he was representing Peter Parker, given that, you know, Happy has like Stark cash and presumably can stump up for any lawyer he wants, like the most expensive law firm in the world. Like, why is a pro bono lawyer representing Peter Parker, you know, and Happy seemingly? But it was great to see him, and that was just a very cool moment when he catches the brick that's flung through the window.
Good to know there's more sort of life in that character, definitely.
Yeah.
And also, we should kind of flag another kind of spoiler klaxon here. If you're not entirely up to date on Hawkeye, then we're going to be going into slight spoiler territory there. Jack, how does this connect us to the most recent episode of Hawkeye as well?
Well, in episode 5, we find out that the big bad roaming around New York is, in fact, Kingpin. And it's the same actor, Vincent D'Onofrio, playing Kingpin again. And we only see it briefly in like footage on a phone, and he's talking to Kate Bishop's mum, Eleanor Bishop, who's seemingly also a villain in this show. Apparently, in New York, Kingpin's still at large, and he's wearing his iconic white suit again as well, which is really cool. And he's such a great actor; he's so great in that role. Again, it's just, you know, all part of the Daredevil show absolutely nailed what they did in the casting, especially. And, you know, it is really good to see them back. I mean, I've kind of forgotten what happened in those shows. I definitely watched all 3 seasons, and I remember like Kingpin being like in and out of jail a few times. And I remember like ninjas coming. There was Elektra for a bit, like the Punisher. Like there was, again, like on this homework thing, like I kind of hope that like they take the characters and they use them, but it's like there's no references to like what happened before, because I could just do like a fresh restart. And also, like, I mean, the only reason they can appear now is because I think the Netflix and Disney contract for those characters like ran out. So Disney can now use those characters again, which is really cool. But yeah, I hope they're like just new, and we don't have to go back and like there is no way I want like Finn Jones coming back as Iron Fist.
Oh,
you know what I mean?
No,
like,
thanks.
Those shows were like so bad. And like, even the, like, just redo the Defenders, like Sigourney Weaver, bring her back. She's great. But like the show absolutely wasted her. I just remember covering these shows and being like so depressed, like, because they were all like 13 episodes long as well. Sorry, this is a Netflix rant all of a sudden. Like 13 episodes. Like, this was like when Netflix were really like just making sure everything was like seasons were exactly the same length. Everything was just kind of like dictated, and that kind of like when they were just starting up. And so, like, I remember the main issue being like, they were all really good for like 7 or 8 episodes. Like Jessica Jones, really good for like 8 episodes. And then suddenly we just nosedive like really, really hard. And I almost feel like the Disney Plus shows, and something with Hawkeye, like we haven't seen the last episode yet. And I feel like there's so much to wrap up in this final episode, where like maybe they could do more episodes. Like, I don't know. Like,
Jack, you're never happy, like, is basically what you're saying. Come on.
Oh, look, there's a happy in between, and that's like
9
combined
episodes.
The two. Yeah. No, well, again, WandaVision was 9 episodes. Loved WandaVision. There you go.
Yeah, just to bring it back to Spider-Man a bit, there is like a really interesting connection between No Way Home and Hawkeye, partly because of the Daredevil connection, the fact that we've seen Matt Murdock and the Kingpin turn up in 2 different shows/films in the same week, basically. That's interesting. But also we see Spider-Man swing past like posters for Rogers the Musical, and that final scene is set at Christmas, and he swings over the Rockefeller Plaza Christmas tree, which is, you know, something we've seen in Hawkeye. So it almost feels like these two must have been made with, you know, that cooperation in mind, the fact that they're sort of connected.
I mean,
that's really fascinating.
they've timed it absolutely perfect, haven't they? In the sense that didn't the Hawkeye episode with Kingpin come out the same day that No Way Home opened in cinemas? Didn't they both come out on the Wednesday? Though, which is just just insane kind of synergy, isn't it?
Yeah, very lucky timing. Or they've been planning this all along, and I'm sure, given Kevin Feige, it's the latter.
All right, okay. On that note, though, let's move from Kingpin onto the villains of No Way Home. What were you guys' highlights, lowlights, surprises in terms of the villains? Because we obviously knew from the start that we knew Doc Ock was definitely back, and Goblin, and even towards the end we knew Electro was back. How did it all work for you?
My highlight was definitely Willem back as back as Green Goblin with his split personality again. You know, I mean, it's hard to, because the first Spider-Man is just such a great movie, and even like, and the second one is also argue, you know, if not better, but you know, those films are so reliant on their villains. You know, they give like half the screen time to just like Doc Ock's and Green Goblin's kind of motivations. They're just really great films, and so bringing them back felt like it just really worked. And I had recently rewatched those Tobey Maguire films, so I just kind of like it just all clicked into place. And I thought Alfred Molina, like back as Doc Ock, he just played it really well. It was, and Willem, like, you know, the split personality, it was just really fun. And I thought they were both, yeah, really excellent. And I like that they didn't necessarily force them to be like all out evil all the way through. It wasn't like they came back and it was just like kill Spider-Man. I mean, it was a bit at the beginning, but then you kind of, yeah, they kind of went back and brought back the inhibitor chip with Doc Ock and that kind of thing. And I was just like, oh, I'm glad they've kept that up.
Yeah.
And it is, you know, it all works with those films rather than kind of ignoring that and just making them evil. Even Sandman, who, you know, not really in the film very much, but his motivation is he just wants to go home to his daughter. He has a nice moment with Tobey Maguire's Spider-Man, where it's like, actually, you know, at the end of Spider-Man 3, they weren't like wanting to kill each other. Like the whole point of Spider-Man 3 was that Tobey Maguire's Spider-Man kind of let him go in the end. So I would say, though, like Doc Ock and Green Goblin were definitely the highlights. The other three, they were fine. I mean, what did you guys think of Electro? I mean, Jamie Foxx kind of made it quite a big thing about coming back.
I'm in total agreement with you that the Green Goblin and Doc Ock were real highlights. The other villains just felt like a waste of space to me, to be honest. They felt like real filler. Like, most of them barely had anything to do, especially Sandman and the Lizard. There's that weird scene where they go back to Happy's flat and then they just like leave the Lizard in the van. Just felt like the weirdest just excuse for not having a character in the scene ever. Like, it's very bizarre. They clearly didn't want to fork out for having like two completely CG characters in the scene, you know. It's very, very weird. And Electro was a very odd one because, you know, Jamie Foxx's Electro when they made Spider-Man 2 is probably one of the worst comic book villains ever. Like one of the worst performances, just very poorly conceived from the start. So they reinvent him here and justify it by the fact that the, you know, the energy feels different in this universe or something. So now he's like super cool and not a total dweeb with like a parting and a gap in his teeth and all blue. That made no sense. Like, it just felt like that was an acknowledgement that, you know, we can't do that again in this film. We want to give a great actor in Jamie Foxx something worthwhile to do. But then they don't actually give him anything worthwhile to do. He has a very boring fight in a forest where he just kind of floats there and throws electricity bolts about a bit. He gets a slightly different costume, which he's in for approximately 3 minutes. And that's basically it. And then he just throws a few quips around. There's a very weird inconsistency with Electro as well, because they justify all these characters coming into the MCU by saying that they know Peter Parker is Spider-Man. That's the thing that draws them to this universe. But Electro never knew that Peter Parker was Spider-Man, right? Like, it's been a few years since I saw that film, but he never actually finds that out. And that scene at the end where he says, oh, I thought you'd be black, you know. So he clearly doesn't know who Spider-Man is. So what is he even doing in this universe? It doesn't make any sense.
My memory was too hazy to kind of question that in the moment, to be honest. But yeah, now you say it, it does. I don't remember him knowing, but like, I've kind of largely blocked that film from my memory anyway, to be honest.
Yeah, I have another issue with this, with the post-credit scene, which we'll get to when we talk about the post-credit scene. But there's another logical, you know, internal logical inconsistency. But again, Sandman just felt like he was just making up the numbers, to be honest. Like, it didn't really feel like they had anything worthwhile to do with him. And they just thought, it'd be nice to have one villain from each film in. Yeah. And that was the only reason why they did it.
Yeah, I was surprised they actually got Reese fans back as well, because when it was just pure CGI lizard, I thought, oh, Reese has clearly said, like, no way, I'm just not coming back, because he's kind of spoken before. It sounds like he didn't have the kind of greatest experience on the film. And so I thought, oh, they've kind of covered that by just doing CGI. But then you do briefly see him at the end, so it's like he must have agreed to come back.
Good Christmas if you're a Reese fans aficionado. You've got this and the Kingsman to look forward to, if you haven't. I mean, you should have already seen this, but you got the Kingsman to watch as well.
So yeah, he's back. He's back, baby. And another kind of, talking of plot holes, what I thought you might have said as well, which I'll just briefly mention, is they were called in from the sort of moment of their death, weren't they? Is that, did I understand that correctly? Because this was something I couldn't quite get my head around, because they were pulled in from the moment of their death. So they hadn't kind of aged as such from when we knew them in their films. But obviously, Tobey Maguire and Andrew Garfield had carried on living in their respective worlds. So they'd come back from effectively like their present day. So they had aged where the villains hadn't, which took me a while to kind of get my head around that. And also, I kind of couldn't quite get my head around that. Like, if they were saved just before the point of death, when they get sent back, are they not like, was Goblin saved just before he got kind of stabbed
Impaled.
With his glider? Yeah. So is he going to go back like a second before that?
How is being like a good guy going to save him from that? Yeah. You know, doesn't give him knife-proof armor, I mean, does it?
Well, one can only presume that maybe they get a bit more time when they get back. Sort of, jump to an hour earlier or something. But
they make the point, wasn't it, with Doc Ock, where he's just like, oh, he had his metallic arm around Spider-Man's neck or something, and then he like got transported over to this universe. So it's like, yeah, you've got like 2 or 3 minutes basically, like, before you die. I mean, even with Doc Ock, like, I mean, the thing is, he's in Spider-Man 2, he is like, he has a last minute redemption anyway. Like, he makes this mini sun in the movie, and then he's like, it's like, oh, it's gonna destroy New York, and then Spider-Man kind of like turns him around at the last minute, and he sinks the thing himself and stops New York from exploding or whatever would have happened. So he kind of already had his redemption anyway. And so my thing was like, well, if they're gonna save him, and then he's gonna go back and he's gonna have to save the day and die all over again, just as a, you know, with his inhibitor chip working. So that doesn't really work. Some of the others do work. Like, I guess, like, Lizard's just going to be a normal man.
He's turned back into a normal man at the end of The Amazing Spider-Man anyway. Like, he sat in a prison cell at the end of that film as Kurt Connors. I can't even remember who it is now. Like, someone turns up in his prison cell. God, it's been so long since I've watched those films. But yeah, he doesn't even die. So it's like, he's got nothing to lose. He can just go back whenever and he'll be fine. He just won't be a lizard guy.
I mean, Sandman doesn't die either. He kind of just stands off into the dish, blows off. Yeah. And it's like, I don't know. Like,
they wanted to have their cake and eat it very much, didn't they? With these,
the whole like motivation for Peter Parker being he has to save these people, it only really applies to like two of the characters, maybe three, if you're being generous.
Mm.
Peter Parker is like never, it's not like in the end of like Man of Steel where Superman like kills Zod or something. Like, he's never done it on purpose. Like, it's always been an accident anyway. He's always kind of tried to save the day. So it does feel slightly odd. And I guess, again, you know, going back to Holland's Peter Parker, when he actually does want to kill Green Goblin, like, with all this kind of like context and trying to save them all and stuff. And then like, oh no, but he's going to kill this guy now. I don't know. It just like just feels like something that
you really didn't like that moment, did you, Jack?
I have a lot of issues with it. It just like, it was one of the only points of it, like, all these things we're talking about. Like, when I was watching it, I was like just having a good time. The spectacle of it, everything about it, like, I was really enjoying it. If someone asked me like straight away after coming out of it, I'd have been like, it probably was more like a 4-star to me. You know, I had a good time. That was the moment, though. Mm. I was questioning it in the cinema right there and then, going, this feels weird. Whereas the rest of it, I was just like, I wasn't thinking like, oh, that doesn't make any sense with Electro. I was just like, oh, they made Jamie Foxx cool. Nice.
I don't disagree. It's an odd moment. As I outlined before, I don't see Tom Holland as like an angry person. Like, he's just not an actor I can believe who has a vengeance streak running through him. But it was one of those moments that I felt, again, was engineered, because I think they wanted a moment where Tobey Maguire, Spider-Man, has this sacrificial moment to save someone, you know, like they wanted to recreate him stopping the train at the end of Spider-Man 2, basically. Because that's just, it's such a moment of heroism that's just totally linked up with that character. I felt like they needed a moment like that, and they reverse engineered it, not entirely successfully, but I did love Toby diving in to do it. I love that it was his Spider-Man that did it. Like, they got that that is the essence of that character. He's just pure heroism, like totally sincere, no bones about it. Like, he would absolutely do that, even though he probably knew he was going to get hurt or die as a result of it. Like, I did love that they made that choice.
You're probably right. For the most part, they definitely understood like who the characters were and delivered in that sense. And so, yeah, the logical inconsistencies that we're talking about and the kind of like some of the weirder decisions. I mean, A, most of the weirder decisions were made by people actually like already in the MCU to kind of bring back those other characters who, you know, definitely felt like they understood Doc Ock as a villain, you know, with him even like in the final fight, like he just wasn't really there because actually he's kind of a good guy. You know, all these sorts of things. But it was just the groundwork to like get to these points when you actually like dig deep and think about it. It's just like, not sure this all really holds up. But maybe, you know, that's why we're here doing a spoiler cast, because we care too much about these things. Everyone else has just gone and had a good time, and then we're there like,
we're just overthinking it.
Yeah. Talking of that sort of ending for Tom Holland's character, where do you think we're going next with him? Because obviously, you know, the spell's been cast now so that he's been forgotten about by everyone. Again, a thing that's kind of hard to get your head around. You have to just take a leap of faith that, because nothing else really seems to have changed in the world in a sort of It's a Wonderful Life kind of way. Everything still seems to be normal, just simply that no one can remember him. So that's just how this spell works. Everything's happened the way it's happened up to this point, but no one remembers him. But yeah, what do you think's next for him? Do you think we are going to get another trilogy of Tom Holland films after this? Would you feel like he could leave it here?
Nothing's confirmed, of course, but they have been talking about the possibility of more Tom Holland starring Spider-Man films, which I feel would be a smart choice given where they leave this film. They essentially leave Spider-Man and Peter Parker at the end of this film in a very sort of traditional Spider-Man place. He's sort of on his own in an apartment fighting crime with a suit that isn't made of Stark Tech, that's a homemade thing that he's thrown together. Like, that's just pure Peter Parker Spider-Man from the comic books. It has none of the MCU trappings anymore. It's just been completely shorn of all the MCU-ness of it all, which I was quite excited to see him back in that place, because, you know, it's something we've discussed a fair bit in The Office, the fact that Spider-Man is so tied up with Tony Stark and his technology. And it certainly felt in those first two films that the technology almost took a precedence over the Spider-Man-iness of it all sometimes. Like, it felt like you didn't really get to see Spider-Man do his thing because he had like death arms like sprouting out the back of him. Like, I don't want to see people getting impaled by like little Tony Stark death arms. Like, I want to see him swinging around and webbing people. Didn't feel like Spider-Man's done. So I was really happy where they left things, especially the fact it was, you know, this very comic book authentic homemade costume. Like, that was just a really, really lovely touch to end on, I thought.
It does feel like these three movies have suddenly become like a weird origin story for Spider-Man. I know, like, everyone always kind of goes on like, you know, we've ignored the origins of Spider-Man. We don't see him getting bitten by a spider or Uncle Ben or anything like that. But like, we've kind of seen those things instead play out just slightly differently. You know, Aunt May fulfills that Uncle Ben role. And so now we do basically just have like the same spot where Tobey Maguire's Spider-Man was in the first Spider-Man film. Like, we've just taken it back. And yeah, I agree with Jordan. I'm like really excited to see where they could go with that. But I also don't know if they will do that, because, you know, there's still going to be Avengers movies. There's still going to be like, apparently the Avengers, they still know that Spider-Man's there. Like, J. Jonah kind of refers to Spider-Man still being out at large. So I'm presuming the Avenger, like, he's still an Avenger. They just don't know he's Peter Parker.
Well, Happy still knows about Spider-Man, doesn't he, obviously?
Because yeah.
He says he knows May through Spider-Man when they're stood at her graveside at the end. So, yeah.
Still, that doesn't make sense. Like, how does he know him through Spider-Man? Like, how is that explained? Is it just like a blank in Happy's mind? Like, oh, yeah, Aunt May, like, you're the aunt of Spider-Man? Like, wait a second. But I do genuinely think, like, you know, it could be really, really exciting if they do just kind of like keep it at a low key level, bring in like a smaller villain for the next one. There have been many hints towards Miles Morales already. The, you know, the Spider-Man we saw in Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, who's like a long running comic book character, also in the Spider-Man games. Like, we could very well see Holland's Peter Parker kind of like raising a new Spider-Man in Miles, which is also, you know, if Holland wants out of his Spider-Man contract, and he's made many comments about, you know, wanting to leave the series behind, it's very much an alternative that they could pursue and just bring in another Spider-Man.
That's definitely a way that they could up the stakes a little bit as well, because the trouble they will have is, where the hell do you go from like three generations of Spider-Man, like five villains, the climax, like a big multiversal story. What do you do after that? You can't just have like a single villain movie, surely. Like, we're going to be getting a Kraven the Hunter film in a few years with Aaron Taylor-Johnson, if that ever happens. But could you imagine if it was like just Kraven the Hunter? Like, that'd be rubbish. But if you introduce Miles Morales, like, that is genuinely exciting. Like, I think that would... yeah, that would be a reason to make the film, right? If you introduced a character like that. So that could be very cool. We still haven't seen Mary Jane either, have we? Properly, I guess. Because it's Michelle Jones, right? So this is a different universe MJ. Maybe there's a Mary Jane out there. Maybe there'll be a
Gwen Stacy.
Maybe another MJ love interest. That would be quite interesting. I would be intrigued to see if they do bring MJ and Ned back into these films, if they ever make any more.
They've got to. I think they've got to.
That feels like a real break, that final moment, though. I mean, it's very consciously distancing those characters. You know, there's a moment where you can reunite them, and they choose not to. So it makes me wonder if they will start with a clean slate with the next films.
To me, I think because there is that great chemistry between Zendaya and Tom Holland, I feel like people just want them back together, and it's like another thing for them to tease for a while, but I'm sure they'll find a way back together.
Yeah. And how it's going to connect to the MCU as well, because them not knowing who Spider-Man is, like, is Spider-Man part of the Avengers still? Is he just going to be having solo adventures from now on? Because obviously MCU characters have been such a huge part of the Spider-Man trilogy. Tony Stark in the first film, Nick Fury in the second film, and Doctor Strange in the third film. Are they going to do that again? It's obviously been a very mutually beneficial relationship between Disney and Sony to have this crossover between Disney MCU characters and Sonyverse Spider-Man characters. But is that agreement going to persist? Like, who knows?
Who knows? Final thing then, as the final thing of the film, let's dive into the end credits with you. First one featuring, of course, Tom Hardy as Eddie Brock / Venom. What does this mean for the future of the MCU?
Who bloody knows what it means, Matt? Because they brought him to the MCU in Venom 2 post-credit scene, and then they zip him out in this one. What I quite admire, though, is that Kevin Feige obviously kind of just wanted to bring in Venom into the MCU. And so it's just like, right, we'll bring him over. And then I don't want Tom Hardy's Venom. Like, we don't want to mix the streams too much. So we're just going to give him back, but he's going to leave a bit of symbiote behind. So we can now have a very different Venom in the MCU. I'm hoping it is the actor who played the barman, who's from Ted Lasso.
Ted Lasso,
Because that would be incredible. Danny Rojas, football is life. That would be amazing. We want to see that. Like, also, if that happens, are we getting two on-screen Venoms at the same time? Like, is there going to be the MCU Venom and then Tom Hardy's Venom? Yeah. Yeah, like, it feels like this could get very messy. I mean, in an ideal world, we're going to have Venom in the MCU, and that will be like Spider-Man 4. And then there will be Venom 3, which is like Tom Hardy's Venom going against Andrew Garfield's Spider-Man. And and we can have that movie. That would be...
God, can you imagine? I mentioned this earlier about the logical inconsistencies, so I'll just pick up on that. One, it doesn't make sense that Venom is even brought into this universe because he has no idea who Peter Parker or Spider-Man even are. So why has he been transported into the MCU in the first place? And secondly, why does that bit of symbiote stay behind? Like, why doesn't Strange's magic spell account for that as well? Again, it just felt like they wanted to get to a place where they had a bit of symbiote in the MCU and they just thought, that'll do. we sort of done Jordan... it. So that's fine.
I've had a lot of angry emails over the last week or so since I wrote a piece about this, and a lot of people saying that it's not logically inconsistent because the hive mind that is Venom would have known that Peter Parker is Spider-Man because Venom is like all the symbiote knowledge or whatever in this hive mind makes it so. I don't know if that makes sense.
He clearly doesn't know that at the end of like the carnage and stuff. He's like, who's that? He looks tasty or whatever. Like, he's clearly not like, oh, there's Peter Parker. He looks tasty.
Yeah.
Doesn't make any sense.
Okay. And so, of course, the other end credit sting was basically like a trailer for Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, which we haven't had one of those trailer end credit stings for a long time. You reminded me, Jordan, was it the trailer for the Avengers at the end of Captain America, the first Avenger? Was that the last time we had a kind of trailer instead of a little mini scene?
Yeah, it's basically a trailer. It's like a kind of teaser of upcoming scenes. Yeah, it's a long time since we've had something like this. It's kind of mind-blowing in a way if you think about it, because... I mean, on a inside baseball kind of level, because there's basically a trailer for an upcoming Disney film at the end of a Sony film, which is kind of mad. Like, I don't know how they were able to push that over the line. I mean, it totally makes sense because Strange is obviously a huge part of Spider-Man No Way Home. And there's also in the meta sense that, you know, Spider-Man No Way Home is bringing back characters from Sam Raimi's Spider-Man films. And of course, Sam Raimi is the director of Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness. So that all connects very neatly. I'm just wondering what the conversations were like between, you know, Sony and Disney executives, where Kevin Feige or Marvel Studios or whoever went, can we just put a trailer for our next film at the end of this? That good? Yeah.
What did you guys actually think of the trailer?
I thought it was interesting. Again, it made me slightly scared about how much I have to watch beforehand. I mean, Doctor Strange isn't one of my favorite characters in the MCU, but I really like the idea of having like a really weird multiverse movie where, you know, we've had a taste of it now where we've had Spider-Man kind of come back from all these universes. I'm ready for a movie that's just going to be like, there's going to be an evil Doctor Strange. There's going to be like a Doctor Strange who's a pig, basically into the Spider-Verse, but it's into the Strange-Verse. there are so many possibilities. I mean, we've seen rumors of like certain characters coming back, Loki coming back, of like Captain Carter from What If coming back in that movie and stuff. And, you know, we saw there was like a Squiddy villain in this, in the trailer, like, all these things that it really could just go crazy with. And I really hope they do, because I think like that's the exciting thing. And we saw like, you know, mirror dimensions and things, just like some incredible visuals in this trailer, like too much to take in almost in such a short space of time. It's got me excited, I think, strangely, because I wasn't that excited for it, but I do also love Sam Raimi. I'm excited to see what he does with it. And I think it could be like a lot of fun. It could really just like use the multiverse concept as this kind of crazy thing. So I think a trailer in that way, I think it was very effective. I mean, Baron Mordo, is that his name?
Mordo.
Yeah. You know, he's back and he's like, you know, got dreads now and stuff, which is, he looks pretty cool.
I'm into it.
I think the carrying over of threads from the first Doctor Strange, I'm like, do I care? Sure. You know, maybe I'll probably rewatch it before. But you have to do it as a sequel to that film, surely. I don't know. Anyway, go on, Jordan, what did you think?
It's a sequel to 25 films at this point, isn't it? Yeah. Like, that's the thing. And several TV shows. But yeah, again, I mentioned this earlier, but it's interesting how much this looks like it's going to be a sequel to What If more than anything, because that squid creature appears to be the same one from the first episode of What If. So there are things that are tying into from multiple episodes of that show, even ones that aren't connected to Doctor Strange. But yeah, I thought this just looked terrific. Visually, it looked amazing. We didn't actually speak about Doctor Strange a great deal in No Way Home, but I actually thought that the mirror dimension fight between Doctor Strange and Spider-Man was actually one of the strongest set pieces in the entire film. I thought it was just terrific. Visually, just super inventive and cool. And I loved the whole math versus science thing. Like, I just thought that was such a great, like, you know, who would win in a fight between, like, the way to solve that question between Doctor Strange and Spider-Man. I thought that was wonderful. So I'm well up for more like crazy mirror dimension stuff. I just love the visual invention of what they do with those set pieces. They always deliver on those. And just the fact that Sam Raimi's back directing another superhero film. Well, the fact that Sam Raimi's back directing full stop is incredibly exciting because it's been so long since Oz the Great and Powerful. And the fact that he's directed another superhero film is, I just can't wait. And I love the fact that they're bringing in Wanda, they're bringing in all these elements from What If. I think they could do some very, very exciting stuff in this film. And the trailer didn't temper my excitement in the slightest. It's also very weird to only see a trailer in the cinema nowadays, just because I'm so used to getting a Marvel trailer and poring over it.
Yeah, to watch it again straight away,
Yeah, so it's like, I kind of want to go and see No Way Home again just to see this trailer again.
Yeah, I'm sure I will see it again at Christmas because I'm sure there's like family members of mine that will want to revisit it. And I'll happily kind of, you know, dig deeper into it as well and look for some more Easter eggs and see how it plays. I always find it just very interesting how a film plays once you know the big surprises, because there's so much expectation in that first viewing and there's so much kind of tension almost waiting to see if things are going to meet your expectations of what you kind of hoped might happen. But now that I'm going into it knowing this, it'll be interesting to see how it plays and sort of how satisfying it is, and if there's anything that even, you know, works better or worse. Basically, that brings us to the end of our Spider-Man No Way Home spoiler discussion. So that's it for us for now, but look out for our Review of the Year podcast, which is coming soon. And we've also launched a new podcast strand. If you search for Total Film's Last Picture Show on your podcast provider, and in every episode of that podcast, a guest shares the four films they program at the cinema on their very last day on Earth. And there's a few episodes of that up already, with more to come in the new year. So if you like the sound of that, please subscribe. And so with that, there's just time for us now to all say bye. So bye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.
Spider-Man, Spider-Man, does whatever a spider can. Spins a web any size, catches thieves just like flies. Look out, here comes the Spider-Man.